Colleagues and friends, good afternoon, or good night, which one is good evening. Let me introduce myself to you. I am Carissa Etienne. I'm the Assistant Director General of the World Health Organization for Health Systems and Strength and Services. It is indeed my great privilege to chair this session on the interface between health systems and global health initiatives. Represented on this dais today are some of the best minds on the subject, and you will agree with me. This evening, we will have two panels. The first will be moderated by Dr. Julio Frank, and the other by Professor Sewitt. Panelists are drawn from member states, from academia, from the global health initiatives, implementers, and civil society. I also, however, recognize that in the audience with us here this evening, many who have contributed to this growing debate. Ladies and gentlemen, I just want to share a few thoughts with you this evening. There is no doubt that in the last decade, the political attention that has been focused on global health has been unprecedented. And it is also of no doubt that the development assistance for health in low and middle income countries has increased dramatically. This has been due in large part to the global health initiatives, which have emerged as an established part of the aid architecture. These global health initiatives have been successful in dramatically raising the level of resources for health, in part because of the specificity, particularly in relation to HIV/AIDS and other health-related MDGs, and in part through their focus on linking inputs to results. Increasingly, however, the global health community, including the GHIs, are recognizing that weak health systems constitute a major constraint to delivering maximally on their goals. We have heard this stated quite eloquently today by President Clinton. And this is a cause of growing concern and debate in the international community. This has led to the opening of a health system window by the Global Fund and Gavi to PEPFAR's work on human resources for health, to name a few. The fact is that health systems in many countries have been weak, and many are at the point of collapse, having suffered inter alia from the reforms of the 80s and a chronic lack of investment both nationally and by the international community. It is clear that unless we invest in building and strengthening health systems, the prospects of achieving the health-related MDGs are grim. People will continue to suffer, and the poor and vulnerable will continue to suffer disease and impoverishment. And that is despite the resources that have been raised on their behalf. We have heard and read many reports of how the global health initiatives are contributing positively to various aspects of the health systems. We have also heard that the GHIs have sometimes had the unintentional effect of weakening some aspects of the health system. The challenge is, therefore, how do we ensure the greater possible synergies between health systems and disease-specific programs? Colleagues, it is not a case of either or. We do not have this option. It is neither also a case of moving resources from one area of response to support another. It is about making sure, one, that all available resources produce the maximum possible benefits in improving the lives and well-beings of our peoples. And it is, two, ensuring that we sustain and increase the flow of resources to disease-specific programs and also to health system strengthening. This is why in the World Health Organization, we are describing our current efforts as maximizing positive synergies between health systems and global health initiatives. This will, of course, demand flexibility and creativity on both sides of the equations, the global health initiatives and health systems. Yes. We can no longer afford the divisions or the dichotomy. WHO is embarking on an effort to consolidate the information and experience to guide policy. We will join efforts with the World Bank, and we will work with consortia of academic institutions from the North and the South and civil society and implementers to examine what works and what does not work, why, how, and in what circumstance. This will require the consolidation of the existing information in a logical framework to convert this information to evidence. The next challenge will be to undertake the essential additional research that may be required to fill any knowledge gaps. This research effort will need to utilize multiple methodologies to capture knowledge where it exists. The next challenge is that we need to work fast. Thousands die each day. They could not afford the wait. And we must work swiftly to develop policy guidelines and implementation tools to ensure effective action. Increasingly, the member states of WHO are indicating that health system strengthening must occur around the core principles of equity, social justice, and solidarity, with emphasis on social participation and intersectoral coordination. These are key values and principles which are at the heart of primary health care agenda and as articulated at Alma Ata. The message we are hearing is clear. Universal access, universal coverage, comprehensive integrated care, which is centered around people's needs and their expectations. I believe we have here both a challenge and an opportunity to reach the unreached, to ensure the well-being for the vulnerable and the marginalized. You will agree with me that we are set to take off. The next generation will judge our efforts. And so it is with great pleasure that I want to introduce Dr. Julio Frank, who is the Senior Health Fellow of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and who is the next dean of Harvard's School of Public Health. And Dr. Frank will make an intervention and will introduce the first panel, which he will moderate. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Carissa, and good afternoon to everyone. As I am the Mexican on this panel, I want to take this opportunity to welcome every one of you to my country, and thank you for attending this historical conference. And speaking of history, this is a country very much embedded in history. I think we are at a historical moment in global health, and it's up to us to take advantage of it. We have seen the rise of attention around global health initiatives of unprecedented magnitude, the most important of which, of course, are about HIV/AIDS, the topic of our conference. And at the same time, during the past few months, there has been truly a burst of initiatives around health systems. From the initiatives by countries like Norway, the UK, Canada, among many others, to those of multilateral organizations, to the agenda of the G8 meeting just a few weeks ago, to the upcoming MDG summit at the UN in September, to the Doha conference on financing for development. These are all unique opportunities to focus the attention on the need to strengthen our health systems. Now, this is very good news, and it is a long overdue interest, but it's going to require a lot of clarity on our thinking about health systems and in our action to improve their performance. I have spent almost a lifetime on this topic, and in my many years dealing with it, I have encountered three very common misconceptions that see health systems as a black box, health systems as a black hole, and health systems as a laundry list. We see health systems as a black box. We don't understand what's going in. So let's just get, you know, some inputs on one side and hope that something will come out the other side. Well, we actually know a lot about what goes on, and we can open that black box. Very often we see among donors the fear that this is a black hole. And like, you know, those dreaded astronomical bodies, we can put all the money inside and no light will come out of them. And very often we tend to see health systems simply as a laundry list without any requirement that this, its components interact in some way. Yet the essence of a system is the interconnectivity among its component parts. So in this very brief introduction, because we're keen to hear from the people who are leading some of these global initiatives, I would like to suggest that as we try to achieve this dialogue, this constructive dialogue that Carissa has just called upon all of us to engage in, that we try to keep five very fundamental questions in mind, which I have found very useful in thinking about health systems. First, what are the boundaries? We need to put boundaries. And particularly to see some things that are not there, and then some things that should be there and we tend to exclude, and particularly people. We tend to think of health systems as something apart from people, from the population. But yet, when it comes to health, people participate, first of all, of course, as patients, but very importantly, as funders through their contributions to the health system, as the citizens who vote for particular dimensions of the health system, and very importantly, health, as co-producers of health. So we need to think clearly how not just the institutional side, but the population side of the health system interact. Secondly, we need to answer, what are health systems for? This is an instrumentality. What are the goals? We have tended to focus on the fundamental goal of improving health, and that is indeed the defining goal. But I believe that health systems should also have goals of fair financing, so that the burden of sustaining that system doesn't fall disproportionately on the poorest or the sickest. And it also has to have an intrinsic goal of treating people decently. So what are health systems for? Third, how do we then characterize the architecture of a health system? What are the functions, and what are the institutions to discharge those functions? We tend to focus only on delivery, but there are other important functions like stewardship, like resource generation, and very importantly, like financing. And then fourth, how can we tell when a health system is performing well? And this has two related sub-questions. How do we know that we have enough resources, whether it's money or human resources, or facilities or equipment or drugs? And then, not just how much, but how well those are utilized. And then finally, the holy grail of health systems. How do we relate certain attributes of architecture to health system performance, to desired outcomes? This is the holy grail because, after all, health systems are an instrumentality to those goals that I mentioned at the beginning. This is, I think, a way of thinking that is very important because one observation we have, if we can make a generalization today, is that countries with exactly the same level of development and exactly the same amount of money going into their health system perform very differently. There's huge variation. Why is that? And how do we learn from those that perform better? And also, how do we learn from those that don't perform so well? So I think this is what this panel is about. We are going to hear from the leaders of the main global health initiatives, and it will be my distinct pleasure to introduce the first part of this panel. We talk a lot now about observatories. So, you know, if you are interested in observatories, here we have the stars that we need to observe. And therefore, I'm going to be very short in their introduction because they are all very well known to each of you. So we have the main leaders in the global health initiatives, particularly those related to AIDS. And we will listen to them about how they're trying to bridge this false divide that has been so destructive for public health between vertical and horizontal. How do we really develop a diagonal strategy? How do we move away from these false dichotomies that Carissa has just warned us about? I think the purpose, and I really celebrate this session, is to have unity of, of in our thinking and in our action. And I think if we actually do that, we will be able to take this unique moment and pull together these two strands, recent strands, the great increase in resources for global health initiatives with the growing interest in health systems. How to achieve that unity is the purpose of our panel this evening. And with that, as I say, we will hear from four of the major leaders. Michelle Kazakhstin, as you all know, Executive Director of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Ambassador Mark Dybul, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and the architect of PEPFAR. Peter Piot, who will be joining us later on, very well known to all of us, the Executive Director of UNAIDS. And Deborah Seudi, the Director of the Global HIV-AIDS Program at the World Bank. So here we have four of the major actors, and we're keen to listen to their thoughts about how to push this agenda of unity so that we achieve our common and shared purposes. With that, let me turn the floor then first to Michelle Kazakhstin, Executive Director of the Global Fund.
Thank you, Julio, for setting the scene. Dear Dr. Etienne, Monsieur le Ministre, cher Monsieur, I would really wish to ask for your indulgence. You know how AIDS conferences are, and I have a major conflict in my schedule with another session, so I did want very much to give a few remarks here, but I will have to leave the session. And Dr. Rifat Hatoun, who is sitting there and who, as you may know, is the incoming Director for Strategy and Policy at the Global Fund, will actually speak, Julio, if this is okay, right after Deborah work, and really bring the in more detail our perspective at the Global Fund. But let me just make three points. The first one, which Dr. Etienne and Julio, you made, is that somehow we found ourselves in an odd situation. As the AIDS movement scales up and shows results and impact, we also find ourselves, or found ourselves, in this odd situation where a debate that has often been abstract or even, I would say, ideological, that is the debate of vertical versus horizontal, has allowed our successes to be depicted as distortions, of which I believe we should somehow be ashamed. Actually, Rifat will be showing some evidence from a Cochrane review that he did of the available evidence, and there is no evidence, there is no evidence for such distortion. My second point is that when it comes to the reality in countries, what we see in countries is two things. First, that AIDS has exposed the weaknesses of health systems like never before, but weaknesses in health systems that did exist before AIDS funding came in. And the second is that AIDS funding is not just about pills or financing a preventive intervention. It is really, it has been moving health overall. It has been moving equity, social justice, human rights. It has reinforced infrastructures. It has supported healthcare personnel. It has built procurement and distribution services. It has strengthened monitoring and evaluation. It has gone into health insurance systems. The Global Fund, for example, has so far committed over $3 billion U.S. dollars to supporting the health workforce. And Global Fund-supported programs has allowed for the training of over 7.4 million healthcare workers throughout the world in the last 6 years. In addition to that, by decreasing the burden of disease, that is of AIDS, TB, and malaria, AIDS, TB, and malaria, quote, vertical funding is freeing time, workforce time, as we heard from Alex Coutinho this morning. And as the Minister of Health of Rwanda said a few months ago, allowing hospitals to become hospitals again and deliver on their normal work, being somehow freed from the pressure of having over 150% beds occupied by AIDS patients and over 100% of the outpatient clinic be patients with malaria. And so these improvements and these results, to me, clearly show that health systems exist, not in the abstract, but really to meet the needs of real people and respond to real diseases. They're here to provide services for diseases that have names. So, really, Julio, again, Frank, thank you for setting the scene. I see we're really on the same page. I think our challenge now is to confidently advance the health system's agenda. Funders of, quote, vertical programs, are strong and fair partners of building and consolidating the health system's agenda. And so, as you said, Julio, I expect from this session a concerted and confident joint effort and move of all of us to show that rather than being part of the problem, AIDS is and will be part of the solution in global health. Thank you.
Thank you, Michel, and we will hear later on from Rifat Atun some more detail about the work of the Global Fund. But let me turn now to Ambassador Mark Dybul, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, please.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to thank WHO and Carissa for hosting this event and for the excellent title that you are using on synergies, so that we are actually focusing on what we can do together. I'd also like to thank Julio as the co-chair of this event. I just asked Julio if anyone's written a book on the extraordinary work he did in Mexico on health systems, and he said no one has. So if anyone in the room wants a great project, writing a book on the extraordinary work he'd done would be very helpful. I don't know how to get my slides up here, so I don't know if someone can tell me. I see my name, but I don't see slides. I'm going to start with something somewhat simple-minded, because I guess I'm a simple-minded person, but I really haven't understood the health infrastructure debates that we're having, because HIV is the first time in history where we're tackling a chronic disease, and you don't get results in chronic disease unless you build health systems. You have to build a system in order to expand prevention care and treatment services for a chronic disease. And so I really haven't understood the debate terribly. I also think, as other speakers have said, we haven't focused on data, and data would be very helpful. And if we can get the slides up, I'd be happy to share some with you. Yeah, I have the flash drive. It's called 2L8. Technology is wonderful. Okay, data. So it's been claimed that too much money went into certain countries, and as a result of that, there was an increase in, for example, infant mortality. The data say exactly the opposite. Thanks to President Mohai's leadership, there was actually a significant increase in infant mortality precisely because of HIV/AIDS. As soon as HIV/AIDS resources increased, the infant mortality declined. If you look at... I'm hitting the green button. What do I point this at? If you look at life expectancy, we see the same thing. Significant decrease in life expectancy precisely because of HIV/AIDS. As resources for HIV/AIDS increased, the life expectancy started to go up. This was the leadership of the Botswana government. I've actually heard people use Botswana as an example of the problem, and they just aren't looking at the data. Another part of Botswana, the Secure the Futures program from Bristol Myers Squibb, 50% reduction in AIDS-related mortality over a two-year period, a reduction in hospital bed occupancy of 50% over a two-year period because of interventions. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a future. In rural Uganda, published in Lancet, Richard, your wonderful magazine, 95% reduction in mortality, 81% reduction in non-HIV/AIDS infant mortality, almost certainly due to the fact that there was a 93% reduction in orphanhood, and we know that an orphan has a much higher rate of dying. These are pretty good general health indicators, infant mortality and life expectancy, and they have infant mortality is going down and life expectancy is going up. So let me talk a little bit about what PEPFAR is doing, and many people are doing things. In 2007 alone, we expended $640 million on capacity building. 87% of our partners were local organizations. In 2007, we spent $321 million in training, and we're going to do another $309 in 2008. A preliminary evaluation of Rwanda, and I've talked to the Rwandans, and people really should talk with them before using their data. 40% of PEPFAR resources they calculate went to supporting the health system. And the only reason the others didn't is because a lot of it went to procure drugs. And when you procure drugs, you're not building the health system. But 40% of their PEPFAR resources, they say, contributed to their overall health system. We partnered with UNAIDS and WHO to launch the normative guidance for task shifting. As many people know, President Bush and Prime Minister Brown announced the healthcare worker initiative, targeting four countries, Ethiopia, Kenya, Mozambique, Zambia. I'm sure Minister Tedros might mention this. The G8 picked this up to expand healthcare workers in general, and HIV/AIDS will contribute to that. In 2008 alone, we will support training for 2.7 million people and support salaries for 110,000 healthcare workers, 110,000. We also allow $6 million per country, or 3% of an overall budget, for pre-service training so that we build the next generation and have a pyramid. I guess that didn't change. We did an evaluation. Data is helpful. 33 PEPFAR-supported fights in four countries. 92% of all the health capacity work being done at clinical sites was through PEPFAR. 92%. Giving a good example, and it includes building and renovation, lab equipment, training. That's where the resources are going, and that's why we achieve results. There's been a criticism that people use non-governmental organizations and that's harming the public sector. Not true. Many non-governmental partners, and here you see all of ours, are actually working in the government sector to strengthen the public health sector. In fact, virtually all of our non-governmental partners are working in the public health sector. Another piece of data. Family Health International looked at 30 primary health centers in Rwanda. They looked at 22 non-HIV indicators and looked at the impact of HIV/AIDS resources on non-health indicators. And what they found is 17 of 22 went up statistically in a statistically significant way. Family planning, antenatal care, syphilis screening, pretty impressive stuff. Now, why did that happen? Well, it makes sense to people on the ground. For example, there was a 20% reduction in hospitalizations, 20%. That increases your healthcare capacity by 20% like that because people were spending all their time on HIV/AIDS are now spending their time on other things. It also makes sense if you just look at what's happening on the ground. On the left was the laboratory at a district hospital before we invested in it. On the right is the laboratory after. You can't get a lot done in the laboratory on the left, but on the right you can. And when you're not using it to run things for HIV/AIDS, you're using it for the rest of your clinic, like CBCs that people are doing for the first time ever in health clinics because of the infrastructure that HIV/AIDS has built and chemistry panels. If you look at the waiting room on the left, not a lot of people want to sit around in that for a day until they get their health care. But on the right, they will, and that's what happens when you invest a little money in the infrastructure. But we don't just renovate, we build. This is a brand new clinic in Tanzania that was built for HIV/AIDS, which freed up an awful lot of space in the existing hospital so that they could use it for other things. And that healthcare worker there, the public health nurse, is being supported, her salary is being supported by PEPFAR. Let me give you a couple of examples which I think are pretty impressive. In Kenya, we're supporting emergency hiring of retired physicians. As many of you know, there are way too many retired physicians, nurses, and healthcare workers. 830 of them have been redeployed back into the sector. These are experts who had been retired. In Zambia, we're supporting rural retention schemes. Just like in the United States, it's tough to get people to work in rural areas, so we're supporting the Zambian government's rural retention scheme. Namibia and Mozambique, we're using a contract mechanism until the governments of Mozambique and Namibia can have people in there, absorb them into the Ministry of Health. We're paying for all those Ministry of Health people now through a contract mechanism. In Tanzania, again, we're doing another retired program to get people out of retirement. In terms of healthcare workers in South Africa, we're supporting the program for a new cadre of clinical health officers, which never existed before. In Nigeria, they're piloting a program to train nursing to provide antiretroviral therapy and PMT-CT in the homes. I'm sure Tedros will talk about his extraordinary program in Ethiopia that we're supporting for general healthcare workers. In Vietnam, we're supporting a new cadre of healthcare workers that never existed before. But it's not just healthcare workers. For the first time, we have a good supply chain system. For the first time, we have three regional distribution sites in sub-Saharan Africa that are covering the continent. And because of these RDCs, we have not had a single stock out through programs that we've supported, which everyone thought was inevitable. But we have supply systems. Those supply systems with computers and air-conditioned warehouses and trucks that go out on time are taking lots of other things besides HIV products with them and building a health system. Monitoring and evaluation. Here's a picture of Ethiopia. For the first time, Minister Tedros knows by mapping where his sites and where programs are being provided. Now he knows where programs are providing in general for healthcare, and he can do a better job with his healthcare system. Same thing's happening in Rwanda and all over, so the monitoring and evaluation is incredibly important. We're also using the healthcare infrastructure to support other things. We delivered 500,000 bed nets in 6 weeks from time of delivery using the healthcare system that was built for home-based care for HIV/AIDS. They covered 1.5 million people after going into the rainy season. We did it at a 75% reduction in cost to the President's Malaria Initiative because two-thirds of the cost of delivering the bed net is the distribution system, and we'd already paid for the distribution system. We're going to do the same thing with the President's Neglected Tropical Disease Initiative, and we'd like to do more with other things. So overall, I think anyone who looks at the data will see that these programs will build health systems. They have to build health systems. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any results. There is no discrepancy between results for HIV programs and health systems. You can't get results for chronic care unless you build a health system. But we need to do a better job, and I'm very excited about this panel because it helps us do that. Thank you very much, and sorry for that.
Thank you, Mark. It was worth waiting for the slides. They were really excellent and very informative. Piotr has a perfect sense of timing. He arrived exactly at the point where it's his turn to share with us his reflections on the synergies between health systems initiatives and health systems and global health initiatives.
Thank you, Julio. It's true, timing is everything, but getting through, even with a motorcade, with the Secretary General, getting through traffic in Mexico is like something I've not experienced before. Anyway, good evening, everybody. It's a bit embarrassing to come in the middle of a panel and then not knowing what other people have said, but I will say what I have to say anyway. And I hope that this is the... For the next slide, whatever. So one of the big unique issues of this conference as compared to previous AIDS conferences is that time is really devoted serious time to discuss health systems, interaction between health systems and AIDS, and that's really long overdue. And I'm optimistic that the connection is finally in the make. I'd like to refer to Margaret Chan's statement last night about the relationship between health systems and so-called vertical program, a term I think we should put in the dustbin of history, to quote Trotsky, since he lived here and was assassinated here. She said, don't blame the failure of health systems on AIDS. It's not a matter of fairness, but it's just not accurate. What I'm doing is a few words about on history, because I think it is important to see where we're coming from. First, because I think the debate, currently debate, has completely lost sight of the massive and debilitating impact that the AIDS epidemic was having on health systems. And just to remind you, this is data from Botswana, how health systems themselves were incredibly burdened by the fact that there was a new epidemic, AIDS, but also that it has put an incredible burden on the health workforce. Again, Botswana lost 17% of its healthcare workforce between 1999 and 2005 because of AIDS. And there are data now from so many countries that illustrate how the impact is of HIV on the workforce itself. But let me go straight to three issues that I'm regularly challenged with or you read about. The first one is that AIDS takes a disproportionate share of global health aid. Secondly, AIDS responses undermine and distort global healthcare systems. And three, there would be far better results if AIDS resources were shifted to general healthcare. These are some three issues that, I read now and then. And these are serious criticisms, and they need to be looked at, and we will do so. When I walked in and heard the end of Mark Dybul, I think that's where the evidence is now accumulating. But before I respond to these three criticisms, I want to reflect on the strength of the evidence. Anne Mills from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine concluded that in 2005 that current evidence on the impact of AIDS investments on health systems is limited, and that there are very few studies providing empirical evidence and an overall poor quality of studies. That was 3 years ago. I think we have now a bit more evidence, but not yet that much. So investing in AIDS is not just about making health systems better, but also about rebuilding systems that were weakened by AIDS. So we need to look at it from both perspectives. More recent conclusions from the Global Health Initiative Network note that the evidence is showing that there is limited, if any, negative effect of AIDS or other priority programs on the coverage of other health services. But that said, let's just quickly take up these different arguments and explore them a little. One, where is all the money? First, global resources for health and AIDS have increased over the last 10 years. And last week, or was it, yeah, last week, the Kaiser Foundation, Family Foundation, issued a report giving some of the evidence. And what you see is that overall resources for health have increased tremendously, but also that the largest increase was AIDS, for AIDS. And that there is no way that we can say that this increase was at the expense of global and overall health expenditure. And I would argue that the overall increase has been driven by the AIDS response, by civil society, political leadership, advocating for AIDS and for healthcare system generally. And because we have been from the beginning adopting a rights-based approach and not a demand reduction approach. Because it's demand reduction that is often has been at the basis for policies. For example, take macroeconomic ceilings impacting health. That's an example of demand reduction. And we have never accepted that. We've said, this is the problem, this is what we have to do. And so that means that we, as the AIDS response has had a very conscious focus on human rights that demands for equal access to treatment between the North and the South, and so on, has been driven this element. And I think there's no reason why not to do that for health in general. Now, has it been distorting or bringing change? My view is that when you look at 6 building blocks of health systems, and I know there are different theories what the health system is, and I'm not an expert in this, but looking across all these, you can see that in every area there are strong and positive contributions from the AIDS response to health sector development. And I don't have the time to go into every element here. But in service delivery, AIDS resources are being used to develop health sector infrastructure. And we've had good examples here that my fellow panelists can bring. And I anticipate that AIDS services will further drive innovation in service delivery, and that will benefit healthcare in general. The current and very necessary attention to health workforce is really an example of that. AIDS resources are also being used to strengthen softer systems such as procurement, supply management, and information systems. Now, when you look at the what happened in the 1990s, and it's just one other element of history, what happened in the 1990s, that is not facetious. 1990s was a period characterized by a strong focus on health system strengthening and health sector reform. And it achieved some progress in some countries, and I think Mexico is definitely one of them. But I would argue that it lost often sight of its goal, improve health outcomes. And it sounds a bit like UN reform. It got totally bogged down into processes and in reforms for their own sake. And what did not occur in the 1990s in any great fashion was a focus upon the basic building blocks of the health system, its human resources, its diagnostic capacity and treatment services. And I believe that the AIDS response has really helped in many of these areas. The 1990s was also the decade when the full devastating impact of the AIDS epidemic became clear. However, attempts to respond to it and provide treatment in the latter half of the decade were resisted. And many arguments were deployed. And I think it's useful to remind them. The health system doesn't have the capacity. Human resources don't have the skills and not enough trained providers. The cost of treatment is too great and it's not sustainable. It's not cost-effective to provide treatment. Now, recently, we hear and it creates entitlements. Treatment is complex, and so on. And it's really at the Durban AIDS conference that was a point when all that broke and everybody came together and said, okay, let's stop arguing and make this work. Now I'm going to the end. I really think that the time is now to go ahead and find the common ground, to focus on concrete strategies and processes. We have the WHO HIV essential packages for the health sectors. We have a growing alliance with the health resource workforce. And if we take a long-term view on the AIDS epidemic, it means also that in order to expand access to treatment, in order to sustain currently the people who have access to treatment, that we have absolutely a very, very solid ground for a strong alliance that is going to make a difference both for the response to AIDS and for the health sector. Now, being from Belgium, I just wanted to, couldn't resist this to make my last point, and that is that the AIDS response is not just the health sector. Let's never forget that. And tomorrow there will be a major session of a series that we, with many others, have published on HIV prevention, a series in The Lancet. You hear that. But let's use the AIDS response to raise the bar for all the health MDGs, for strengthening health sectors, and don't throw out the baby and the bathwater. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. I'm relieved that you navigated the traffic successfully, so you could share these insights. Let me turn to the last presenter on the first panel, Deborah Guerk, Saudi, from the World Bank. Will share her perspective, and then we'll move on for a few questions in case the audience wants to start thinking about posing a few questions after this.
Thank you, Julio. First of all, I am not Joy Fumafi, and I do apologize on her behalf. As we speak, she is launching the bank's program on HIV/AIDS, and that's why she is not here with us, so I'm standing in for her. There is a challenge, and I will start with the challenge. Over the last 10 years, there have been profound changes in the way aid is financed and distributed. Private foundations and funds such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Global Fund, Gavi Alliance, and PEPFAR have entered the scene with large amounts of grant money. And these have brought in with them a number of assumptions pertaining to health systems. And these are some of the assumptions. One, the recent increase in development assistance for health has been directed to specific interventions and diseases. Currently, 13% of development assistance for health is provided through these global funds. The pattern arose from a desire to achieve better impact in the short term in response to lack of progress in many low-income countries. The recent success of these vertical funds include vast increases in access to life-prolonging treatment of AIDS, as well as expansion of access to simple technologies for the prevention of malaria, such as insecticide-treated bed nets and immunization against common diseases. In addition, and speaker after speaker have said it, we owe it to these programs, especially AIDS programs that have brought up the inadequacy of health systems. What are some of the examples of these so-called vertical programs? According to Gavi, in its first 7 years, it has reached an additional 176 million children with new or underused vaccines. The Global Fund recently announced that about 1.75 million people living with HIV have been reached with life-prolonging antiretroviral treatment through AIDS programs, and it supports a 59% increase over results reported a year ago. Similarly, PEPFAR has enabled many poor countries to expand access to ARVs. The Global Fund also supported tuberculosis programs that have so far put more than 3.9 million people on effective treatment for tuberculosis. The Global Fund also reports progress in the fight against malaria, with a cumulative total of 59 million insecticide-treated bed nets delivered to families at risk of contracting the disease through its funded programs. These represent a 98% increase over the quantity of 30 million nets which had been delivered by mid-2007. And finally, the World Bank, as many of you remember, put the first $1 billion for the multi-country AIDS program, which built capacities in many countries and which prepared these countries to handle much bigger resources from the Global Fund and PEPFAR. At the same time, there is a growing concern about the pattern of aid, and here are some of the concerns. While it can be very effective in the short term, resource-scarce environments, separate funding streams for interventions, can result in more waste and inefficiency. With the weak infrastructure and human resource capacity in many low-income countries, separate funding streams for interventions and disease may compete for limited implementation capacity with negative effects on the coherence of overall systems. The external assistance system is also challenged by the plethora of aid instruments and modalities. Aid is often unpredictable, volatile, and short-term, which makes it difficult for recipient countries to budget and plan. Furthermore, the program, disease-specific nature of many aid programs may encourage the development of separate delivery and financing silos and may preclude the development of holistic health systems and sustainable financing at country level. Aid flows also incur high transaction costs for both donors and countries, as they are often based on different administrative procedures and budget cycles. These flows may crowd out important health programs that are not supported by vertical funds. It is therefore critical to support countries to manage such distortions and improve the effectiveness of aid flows. There is also additional assumptions which I will not go into. The issue now is how can we improve overall coherence of financing health system initiatives? The first one is to emphasize improvement of outcomes and concurrent improvement of country capacities for service delivery. The bank will continue to work with a multi-sectoral approach. It cannot be instead of. We should be able to do both. Efforts to streamline aid have been undertaken by the OECD Development Assistance Committee, and many individual donors are trying to harmonize their procedures with those of other donors and international organizations and align administrative processes with recipient country systems. For example, the H8, an informal group of the heads of 8 health-related organizations, was formed to stimulate a global sense of urgency for reaching the health-related MDGs and to share accountability for progress at country level. It has met twice since the mid-2007. We still have a long way to go, but we are moving in the right direction by implementing key elements of the Paris Declaration on aid effectiveness. The international health partnership is a new and crucial development in this context. It's co-led by the World Health Organization and the World Bank, and since its initiation, it has grown to include 15 African and Asian countries and 10 major donor countries. In a sign of broad acceptance, it now includes the Canadian Catalytic Initiative, the Norwegian Program of Results-Based Financing. The IHP Plus seeks to align donors and recipient country interests through mutual accountability. It is based on country-focused, country-led processes and plans, including development of a validated, appraised country compact based on a single country health plan linked to the overall development plan and plans of so-called vertical programs and budget with a common results framework. What works in health financing at country level? A recent bank publication on good practice in health financing shows that there is no single best practice. However, most successful equitable expansions of healthcare coverage demonstrate a combination of dedicated public revenue and risk pooling, which may be privately financed. The ratio of private out-of-pocket financing declines as income rises, whereas the ratio of private pooled financing increases, as does the role of government. Countries are experimenting with various types of public-private partnership, including contracting in and contracting out of services, public-private investment partnerships, etc. Studies are underway to evaluate the impact of these partnerships. The bank is also working closely with partners to examine the feasibility of scaling up social insurance programs for the poor, which may offer promising avenues for increasing demand for quality healthcare services. Countries as diverse as Ghana, Rwanda, and India are experimenting with promising approaches. Finally, investing both in disease-specific programs and in health systems are and will remain to be priorities for the bank because we can do both. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. As we heard initially from Michelle Kazakhstin, Rifat Atun will be providing a complimentary view on the work of the Global Fund. He has just been appointed Director of Strategy, Policy, and Performance at the Global Fund, so I think it will be very interesting to hear his comments, which I'm sure will be kept very brief so we can accommodate all the rest of the panelists and have time for some audience participation. Thank you.
Okay. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues and friends. It's a great privilege to be here. I wanted to share with you, if I can get my slides up, moving from the Belgian RELIX, some of the early findings of a study we've recently completed, as yet unpublished, which essentially explored integration versus no integration. Okay. So I'll try and be brief. So there's been a long-standing debate on with polarization views on integration versus no integration, vertical versus horizontal approaches. But this binary argument, as Dr. Julio Frank so rightly identified, is highly reductionist and not necessarily beneficial to anybody. And to date, there has been three short reviews, but these have not been systematic. So with the World Bank, we've entered into a program of work, initially undertaking a systematic review using Cochrane criteria to look at the evidence, look at the nature of evidence for or against integration. Then we extended this to a wider systematic review that included a range of studies that did not meet the Cochrane criteria. Now, I think this is an important slide. I know it's rather late in the day. But we talk about the evidence. Well, we looked at 8,274 articles that met our initial inclusion criteria. And of these, only 12 qualified as being included meeting Cochrane criteria, i.e. randomized control trials, control before and after studies, intra to time series. And we looked at all initiatives, so TB, HIV, malaria, all priority health programs. And our key result is that there's limited evidence for or against integration, and the nature and extent of integration varies. And this is shaped by the context. In fact, there are two groups of studies. One, studies on integrated management of childhood illness, two studies led by WHO, and the rest of the studies were essentially from US and the UK in mental health. So the arguments, the heated arguments around integration versus no integration, the evidence base is not there. We're not able to generalize from the two studies that we identify from developing countries. So clearly then we went on to try and understand the extent and nature of integration, as Dr. Julio Fring talked about, understanding the architecture of health systems to explore what was in this black box. And we developed a theoretical framework based on the empirical studies we've been undertaking over the last 10 years or so, looking at the nature of the intervention, the nature of the problem, the adoption system within which the intervention is introduced, the health system characteristics, and the broad context, which collectively work and interact together to influence the nature and extent of integration. And in terms of integration, we unpacked this further. We looked at the extent to which programs were integrated into critical health system functions. For example, stewardship and governance, financing, planning, service delivery, monitoring and evaluation, and demand generation. And we were able to map, we came up with around 30 studies or so, and we're able to map the extent of integration either as fully integrated or partially integrated or not integrated or unknown in the studies that we identified. Then we also looked at success as described by the authors in the study, either successful in relation to most or all outcomes, mixed outcomes, few or no outcomes, or results unknown. I'm not going to share with you all the findings, but I just want to use two areas to illustrate to you the kind of findings. For instance, if we look at family planning and services, what we can see from the sort of three groups of studies from Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Nepal, that the extent and nature of integration varies as the success. Looking at the health system functions here and looking at the extent of integration, so there's wide heterogeneity as there is with the success. And if we look at HIV AIDS and STIs. There's only one study from Haiti, and again, as you can see, the extent of integration varies, but in this case, the program was deemed to be successful by the authors. So even extending the study beyond Cochrane, we don't have really enough evidence. But what we're able to say is that the argument should not be integration versus non-integration. In fact, integration happens at different levels into different health system functions in different settings, and there are reasons for it. So as Jim Kim will talk about, we'll be entering into a new study led by WHO to try and understand how and why integration occurs and how this impacts on results. So our conclusions from the second set of studies was that the extent and nature of integration varies, so this reductionist approach is counterproductive. Context matters. What we need to do is to develop interventions that are context sensitive, that are fit for purpose in different country settings. So the Global Fund is committed to health system strengthening. So a number of board decisions actually encourage applicants wherever possible to integrate requests for funding for health system strengthening actions within relevant disease components. In addition to this, there's a separate health system strengthening component within the applications. And the Global Fund encourages health system strengthening through direct funding of critical health system functions, but also through positive externalities of targeted programs, by reducing the burden of major diseases, by reducing the workload on health systems because of HIV, TB, and malaria, which in turn releases system capacity. This in turn increases macroeconomic productivity, which in turn we hope should contribute to macroeconomic growth. And if we look at some early evidence looking at impact in malaria of malaria in Rwanda, you can see after interventions, the number of inpatient cases for malaria decreased dramatically. If we look at the number of outpatient confirmed cases, this also declined, and we can see an increase in number of non-malaria inpatient cases. So by reducing the burden from these three major conditions, we're able to create additional capacity within the, or unlock capacity within the health system so as to enable management of other conditions. And in terms of the Global Fund grants, this is all the rounds up to round seven proposals. Around 35% of all funding has gone to health system strengthening, 3% to monitoring and evaluation, and we're encouraging countries to increase investment in monitoring and evaluation up to 10%. Around 9% going to infrastructure and equipment, and around 23% going to human resources. And the figures we have in terms of investment in human resources that up to date, around 6 million health workers have been trained through Global Fund supported programs. And WHO has led a consultation on Global Fund approaches to health system strengthening. And the key recommendations they made, which we're incorporating into our funding rounds, is there should be flexibility in recognizing different country contexts when countries apply for health system strengthening. So keeping the parameters for health system strengthening activities broad and to avoid ceilings on the amounts asked. Secondly, the health system strengthening initiatives should support removing bottlenecks to improve HIV, TB, and malaria outcomes. And thirdly, investment to increase country-level information, which we so desperately lack, increasing technical assistance, but also increasing coordination of different actors in countries. In round seven, around 75%, 113 of 150 eligible proposals contain health system strengthening as strategic actions. And most applicants had three or more. And the TRQ recommended $363 million, around 13% of the amount approved for health system strengthening. Of these, 68% were within HIV-AIDS component, 22% within the malaria components, and 10% within tuberculosis components. In round eight, as you may have heard, this record application from, from partner countries to the tune of $6.4 billion for a two-year period. And the TRP has mandated that we should look at health system strengthening separately, but also as part of global fund, as part of the disease programs. So, ladies and gentlemen, just to summarize, the debate on the binary debate on integrating versus no integration, it's about time we moved away from this dichotomy, and as Dr. Frank has said, to really understand how the health system structure, architecture is working and how these different architectures impact on outcomes in different country settings. Rather than just arguing without evidence, it's time we generate robust evidence to inform policy and investment decisions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rifat. In light of the, I realize there's interest, but we, with my co-chair, Suit, we have thought that we're going to listen to the rest of the panel, and then we'll open for questions, because otherwise we will not have the time to finish with the session. So if you please can hold your questions for a little bit more longer, and it's my pleasure to turn now over the moderator role to Professor Suit from Thailand.
Thank you, Julio. I promise that we will not finish before 9 p.m. I was invited to speak as speaker, but now I have to be a moderator and a speaker at the same time. I will speak anyway. I was asked to inform the audience how my country build up or scale up our health system, which can support any kind of epidemics, including HIV/AIDS. The previous speaker said that HIV reveals the weakness of the health system. But in my country, it's contrary. The HIV/AIDS reveals our strength. HIV/AIDS does not put much burden on health system, but it allows opportunity for us to shine. The HIV/AIDS provides opportunity for new measures for healthcare, for universal access, including the use of TRIP flexibility, compulsory licensing. This is the information on our healthcare system, pluralistic, three-quarter in the public sector, one-quarter in the private sector. We have 4 health workers per 1,000, well beyond 2.3 that the WHO proposed. And this is what a strong healthcare system can do to support HIV/AIDS. Everything from prevention, the very famous 100% condom among commercial sex workers back in early 90s until now, saved millions of lives, all done under the healthcare system. We have now 180,000 people on ARVs, universal coverage to both first line and second line ARVs, all done under healthcare system. All this, we lose less than 300, not lose, but less than 300 health workers, or 0.1% of the health workers are affected by the disease. And with this 180,000 patients on ARV, it only put burden on less than 1% of the health workers, because you have enough health workers. If you invest continuously in a sustainable basis, whatever epidemics, you have adequate healthcare system to support it. We try not to depend on donors. You can see that our government budget increased more than 10 times for ARVs in the last 6 years. The Global Fund budget to Thailand now are used mainly for the migrants and for prevention. We want to depend on ourselves. We know that the Global Fund will not last forever. We know that PEPFAR will not last forever. We know that we have to stand on ourselves one day. So why don't you stand on yourself from the early day? We have universal access to ART as part of the universal coverage to health insurance in 2003, and now also includes second line. Now this universal health insurance also includes renal replacement therapy and seasonal flu vaccine. It is not the fast track, really fast track. It is a 3 to 4 decades of long-term investment and continuous investment. How do we pay for it? Three things. When we are poor, we stop investing in urban hospital. We froze urban hospital investment and shift the money to build up rural healthcare infrastructure. And when we get richer, we are lucky, maybe lucky or not, I don't know, but we have peace and economic growth, which reduce the budget, about 30% of national budget to pay debt and to defense, back into health and social services. And the democratic government, elected government, once you have election, they always come with this populist policy, and health is one of that. So you see that in the early 80s, we froze the budget, almost froze the budget to urban hospital and send it to the rural area to build up rural healthcare infrastructure. Also, from 87 to 97, you see the budget to pay debt down from 25% down to 5%. And also security budget down from 25 to 13%. You see the big increase in health budget. Not only bigger cake, but bigger proportion. And this is the facilities that you build up because you do not stop to invest. You do not reform according to what the World Bank advised you. Well, when we started the universal health insurance, the World Bank consultant came to my office and asked me to tell my government to stop it. We are lucky we do not listen to them. And you see that because of this investment in rural health infrastructure, the outpatient visit moved from a reverse triangle to an upright triangle. Previously, people go mainly to urban provincial hospital. Nowadays, most people, when they get sick, they go to nearby health centers. You have to invest. And how to ensure sustainability? You need economic growth. Donors can do more to help us sustain by stopping agricultural subsidy, by agreeing more to discuss with their pharmaceutical industry to reduce the price of the drug. That are more sustainable measures than just give the money. We need cost control. We cannot go for fee for service in our healthcare system. So we pay our provider by capitation. We use generic essential drug. We use collective procurement. And we use compulsory licensing when necessary. We also have special tax on tobacco and alcohol, 2% special tax on tobacco and alcohol to pay for health promotion, to reduce the burden of disease, to reduce healthcare financing. This is the difference in price of the few drugs that we have compulsory licensing. You see the fourfold increase in access to efavirenz, more than tenfold increase in access to second-line ARV because of the compulsory licensing. I have 4 books here on compulsory licensing, if anyone wants to learn about it in Thai, from the Thai experience. What have we learned? You have to invest. Invest and invest continuously. Don't listen to anyone who tells you not to invest. You have to invest continuously. You need dedicated spirit of health workers. One dedicated health workers is better than 10 financial or money-oriented health workers. And health system is not just healthcare system. It's more than that. It means that every public policy must have health lens, including trade policy. I think I'm stopped now because the light of the time, but I would like to invite the rest of the speaker. We still have 4 speakers. The first one, Honorable Tedros, Minister of Health of Ethiopia. Someone told me that His Excellency is like Che Guevara. So I hope that His Excellency can tell us something about his battle in the jungle, as well as his battle to scale up the health system in this country. And then Jim Kim. This man, from my knowledge, he's a TB man from Peru, but found his place in Harvard and got lost sometimes in WHO. Now he's back at Harvard. And then Asia Russell, an NGO leader, she inspired me a lot when I worked as a board member of the Global Fund, an aggressive but reasonable NGO. And the last person, I'm not sure how should I introduce him. I understand that he is the Assistant Director General of the WHO, but as today he is on holiday. So I'm not sure he come here as an Assistant Director General or himself. But the first speaker, Honorable Tedros, please.
Good evening. I think it's a disadvantage to speak after many excellent speakers, but I will try my best. It's really my pleasure to have this opportunity to say something about the positive synergy. I can assure you that in Ethiopia, the positive synergy is really real, and we live it, we see it all, it's in our daily life, and I'm a witness tonight to tell you about how we're actually dealing with the positive synergy and how real it is. Because HIV/AIDS funding is actually helping us strengthen our health system in a very special way. And for us, it's actually a huge change in paradigm in terms of our health system. And the stronger health system is also helping us to fight HIV/AIDS and other priority areas, focus areas in a better way. As you know, in our health sector development program, we have five priority areas, which is same as whatever we have in the MDGs. And as you know, these are HIV/AIDS, TB, malaria, and problems related to maternal health and also related to child health. So when we developed our health sector development program, we have actually identified these five focus areas in order to give better attention. So we don't want to see HIV/AIDS in isolation. When I say synergy, it's actually about these five focus areas, which are our basic programs, which contribute in a great way to the huge morbidity and mortality in our country. So it's always good to focus, because we cannot really thinly spread, and we can use our resources in a wise way if we can focus. And that's why we have the five focus areas, and not just HIV/AIDS as an exception, but all five areas as an exception. Then after identifying the five focus areas, what we have done is we have identified the basic strategy that can help us fight in a better way. And that was the primary health care, which is really the centerpiece for health promotion and disease prevention. And then we have, after identifying our strategy, which is health promotion and disease prevention, to address all these five priorities, and then we identified the vehicle, which is the primary health care. And in our country, actually, we divide the primary health care into two. The first line being the health extension program, which mainly specializes on health promotion and disease prevention, and the second line, which is mainly on curative services, but basic curative services linked with primary health care. And for these vehicles actually to run smoothly, we need to address systemic issues that really tie up the vehicles together, like the information system, the pharmaceutical supply or the logistics system, the finance and procurement system, and the human resource and development issue, which are actually the bloodline and the core issues of the health system. So we have categorized into three, as I said earlier. One, the major focus areas, then the vehicles, mainly the primary health care, and three, the system issues, mainly that really help the system actually to function properly. So in a nutshell, that's the health sector development program, and we see this as one system, and we have the five exceptions which contribute greatly to morbidity and mortality, HIV/AIDS being one. So it's just treating the whole health system as one. Then from this, as what you can see, HIV/AIDS, including the other focus areas, cannot be actually successfully implemented without a stronger health system or without a vehicle, a major focus being the primary health care. And I can give you one example, for instance, on HIV/AIDS. For HIV/AIDS, you cannot talk about HIV/AIDS program success without linking it with the health program. Because when we talk about HIV/AIDS services, it means geographic access, it means it has also temporal dimension, it has affordability issue. Of course, HIV/AIDS treatment and prevention activities in Ethiopia is actually free, and it has culture and other dimensions, like social dimensions. And that's why actually HIV/AIDS and the other focus areas are actually dependent on stronger health system. If I give you one example, to ensure geographic access, you need to build health centers. In Ethiopia, for instance, to build, to increase access to HIV treatment, we needed to focus on building health centers, and without that, actually, we couldn't expand our HIV/AIDS treatment services. 3 years ago, we only had 900 people on free treatment. Now, 3 years later, we have 150,000 on ART, free treatment, which is 58% of the total need of 258,000. But the remaining 42%, to reach this deep into the rural, we need to expand the health system by building more health centers. And that's why, in order to actually achieve universal access, we need to build additional health centers that are closer to the community to minimize the distance gap and help people to access. And it's through that we can actually achieve universal access. And the temporal dimension, we're working on process reengineering in our hospitals and health centers to minimize waiting time so patients can get better services in the institutions. So when we talk about HIV/AIDS services, then it's mandatory that we should talk about strengthening the health system. So this is one of the examples. But not only that, we need to also prepare the health system by training and retraining. We need to prepare the system to have a robust pharmaceutical supply system, and we need to prepare the system by installing better finance system, better procurement system. When I list all this, it's not just for HIV/AIDS, but it works for all the focus areas and for the other second or third priority health issues as well. And I can give you how HIV/AIDS actually funding benefited in building the health system. A support that was provided from PEPFAR, Global Fund, and Gavi, of course, based on that, we are building 1,200 health centers, brand new actually. And also, we are renovating additional health centers with a matching from the government. And we have established a new pharmaceutical finance and supply system with a revolving drug fund, with construction of warehouses, but not only that, but the software also, the new design for this pharmaceutical supply system, as what Mark was explaining earlier. And we're constructing a good quality control lab for a regulatory function, actually, which will serve HIV and other regulatory functions. But not only the construction, but we're designing a new regulatory system with a one-stop shopping that can help us regulate the services that we are providing. And from the support of PEPFAR, Global Fund, and again, other partners, we have already built a BSL-3 lab for operational research, and the construction is completed, and we're finalizing the design for a better system. And I can give you actually several additional examples of how we're building the system like the blood bank, construction, renovation, and also a new system. And then the HRD, which is a strategy or a plan for 2020 to address basically the low level, mid level, and a part of the high level health professionals by in 4 or 5 years, and that's well underway. And that will also change the paradigm in our health system. But not only that, we have already designed a new information system. It was pilot tested, and we're rolling it down now. It's being implemented. And finally, last but not least, strengthening leadership and management of for the core group of the Ministry of Health in order really to steer the ship in safe waters is also well underway because of the support of, you know, whatever money is coming for HIV AIDS services. So the fund which is being raised vertically is being spent diagonally, or whatever you call it, horizontally. And so I don't think we can undermine the benefits that the health system is getting actually from HIV/AIDS funding, and vice versa also. The health system is also benefiting in achieving better results, not only for HIV/AIDS, but the five areas which I have mentioned. But having said this, I am not saying there is no problem. There are problems, for instance, in HIV/AIDS program that has affected, you know, the other public sector. But after we designed a kind of balance as what I was outlining, the problem is being addressed now, and we need to work in the future to address that. You know, like cost of transactions, lack of harmonization, which still we need to work really harder on that. And for that, we're continuing to negotiate, and the International Health Partnership is one. In Ethiopia, we have signed the Code of Conduct in 2005. A harmonization manual was endorsed by all our partners in May 2007, and our compact for better harmonization is ready to be signed by the end of this month. That can take us actually to a better harmonization and alignment for the future, and I believe that the compact will be signed this month, because there is a good a positive response from all our partners. So harmonization and alignment and integration is actually a process. It cannot happen overnight, but we can really best exploit what is at hand now by just using the interdependent mode of positive synergy that we said about HIV/AIDS and health systems, while negotiating for a better future, better harmonization and alignment for the future. But finally, I would like to thank, I think you will agree with me, and to be grateful for the contribution of the PEPFAR and Global Fund, especially the World Bank on HIV/AIDS, you know, as which is benefiting the whole health system. And I think you will agree with me that we need to give our greatest respect and appreciation for the founders of these really innovative ideas. And it's really good at times to take a pause and say thank you so much, instead of really criticizing for all, you know, despite all the benefits we got from the activists of the HIV AIDS, and also from the programs that are actually strengthening our health system. So I would like to express my greatest gratitude to thank the founders, and I hope the future will be better. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Just want to warn you all that I'm planning to speak until tomorrow morning. So I'll try to be really quick. I want to start by giving just a brief other example. Partners in Health has been working in Haiti for many years. My colleagues Joya Mukherjee and Louise Ivers built these programs. System design was terribly important. The use of very specific modalities like community health workers was important. Years of understanding incentives and other issues were important. All the programs are are built on these foundations. Now, you know, at first with Global Fund money, but then with PEPFAR money, we insisted from the beginning that we were going to build at least four parts that are critical to a primary healthcare system. HIV work, of course, but also TB diagnosis and treatment, STD case finding and treatment, and women's health. Now, that was just the beginning. We expand from there. But what happened was that we turned, this is a functioning health care center in central Haiti. But once, if we were just to have dropped antiretroviral medicines in there, I'm not sure how well we would have done. But providing the full range of primary care services, in a few months, the clinic was swamped. And as part of the task shifting work, Louise Ivers carried out research looking at when you bring into a place like Bukankare here, just HIV money, but the system design is the one that I showed you, then what happens is in a lot of indicators, and this is actually a slide from WHO, the Positive Synergies Group, that was from the task shifting work. And just as Family Health International has shown, a lot of the other health system functions can improve. But this was actually part of the system design. But the question now is that we've heard lots of examples about specific countries. Rwanda, everyone's been speaking about Rwanda, Thailand, of course. There's a bunch of great examples. But the problem now for this group of people, especially on this panel, is how do you take those specific examples and come up with some sort of approach that will help everybody in the world, even with in countries where the health systems are even worse and where system design has gone all over the place. How do we actually help them do better in building, in maximizing the synergies as we've talked about? Well, you know, the focus, I think, still has been on building successful projects in much of the world. That's not the case with Ethiopia. That's not the case with Thailand. It's not the case in Brazil and many other countries. But in many, especially sub-Saharan African countries, what you see is an explosion of different projects. And so what every country needs, and this is exactly what Julio mentioned by the Holy Grail is to find an architecture in which you can build a functioning primary healthcare system that can deliver across the priorities. That's what we need to do. But how do you get there? So you hear a lot, in my own work at Harvard and elsewhere, I've begun asking a lot of unusual suspects. You know, if you ask an epidemiologist or health, you know, many kinds of health systems researchers, a lot of them don't have experience actually in building systems. Dr. Tedros does, others do. So I came to the conclusion that there are a lot of unusual suspects that we need at the table, people like business strategists, management and operations specialists, systems engineers. And I learned, and I didn't know this, that there are all different kinds of systems engineers, ones that do system dynamics and modeling, others that do systems optimization. And I don't think we have enough of them in our group. There are some, but we haven't, certainly when I was at WHO, those are not the people we were talking to. And so in an effort to bring a multidisciplinary group together to really look at this question of how global health initiatives can be harnessed to build health system strengthening, I've been asked by Dr. Etienne and Dr. Margaret Chan and Badar Assam and others to coordinate a group of academic institutions that will work with the Global Fund, with the World Bank, and with the PEPFAR program. All of those groups have agreed very thankfully to be part of this effort to actually try to carry out a study that will look at both quantitative and qualitative data to try to unlock the black box, as Julio said, and move us toward understanding what is it specifically about the various architectures. And there's not going to be a single answer. What we hope to come out of this with is that we'll be able to say, you know, we're actually now developing theory about how to harness global health initiative money to build health systems. So we want to build theory. We want to take specific examples that are very context specific, but are helpful nonetheless. And at the end of the day, if we can come out with the context independent good practices that anyone, any group can implement, but also the context specific elements, the Thai 100% condom case, for example, Dr. Sua, you know, we studied that very carefully, and we're not sure that would work anywhere other than in Thailand. We don't know, But there were a lot of wonderful principles of public health embedded in that project, but there are a lot of specificities about Thailand, we think, that will make it difficult. But the way that they teach in the more systems and operations-oriented schools is that you need to know in a deep way what the context-independent forces for success are, and then entertain in your head many hundreds of great examples of context-dependent successes so that when you come upon a situation, you can make better choices than you would otherwise. So we started now, and we've been talking a lot with our academic partners. We have partners from Europe, partners from Sub-Saharan Africa, and also from India. And we've come up with a really preliminary view of what a health system might look like. And this is based on the World Health Organization's work. It's based on, frankly, Julio Frank's work from years ago. And Dr. Frank is now going to work with us to take this initial idea and try to build out an even more refined framework on health systems functioning. So we're very happy, and I'm especially happy that Dr. Frank is going to be my new boss very soon. But the questions we're going to ask first on a macro level, and this work is going to be led by Chris Murray at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation and our colleague Chunling Liu, is to get cross-national macro-level data on just what health investments have done. For example, have global health initiative investments crowded out government spending? Are countries taking health sector budgets, and then once they get this extra money, simply moving their money elsewhere? We also want to utilize Rifat Atun's methodology that he's developed on doing comparative case studies, and Rifat's going to be one of the leaders of this our group, to look at how governments have made decisions on how to use global health investment money that have had an impact on health outcomes. But we also want to get down to the coal face level to look at how those decisions in those countries have actually affected outcomes. For example, have particular system designs led to better health outcomes? And more importantly, have particular systems designs led to good outcomes in the target diseases, but also good outcomes in the non-targeted diseases? So let me just end by saying what we think we can come up with at the end of the day are these kinds of data that I don't think we've had enough before, and it's certainly not data that were generated with this consortium of both academic institutions and all the major players. We need all the existing data on HIV and its impact. Rifat Atun has done most of that work. There's more gray literature and other things that we need to look at, but the study that he talks about was a very good start for us. We need a case library. We need to know in great detail, with management and operational detail, how particular programs have either successfully or unsuccessfully strengthened their health system with HIV money. We need frameworks for investigation. How do we even think about researching positive synergies? And Rifat has developed a lot of these ideas. Julio Frank has worked on these ideas. And we think this consortium can go further. Also, a framework for evaluation. The Doris Duke Charitable Foundation has put out a challenge to come up with an evaluation framework for looking at how disease-focused money might have specific impacts on health system strengthening. It's the African Health Initiative, and they put $100 million out, and I think that's really annoying. Sorry, I'm finishing right away. The final thing that I'll talk about is that once you have these insights, we have to make use of the internet and of the way that people communicate with each other. Facebook, MySpace, these communities of practice have exploded, and they've exploded nowhere more than in business. So if we can take these insights and share them with each other on a continuing basis, we could develop a way for taking very practical questions, putting them out there into this community of practice, and getting very practical answers back from others that are building health systems. We're very excited about this work. We're excited to have everyone involved. And what we hope to do is to unlock the black box and say it is not about putting HIV with health system together. There are so many intervening variables. Let's figure out what they are and package them in a way so that anyone in any country can make use of them. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Asia Russell, and I'm part of HealthGap, an organization working for universal access through policy and advocacy and through strategic partnership with grassroots organizations in developing countries. Dr. Etienne, Honorable Minister, thanks very much for including a civil society voice on this important panel, and Dr. Etienne in the important work that WHO is taking forward on positive synergies between global health initiatives and health system strengthening. I was asked to speak from a civil society perspective about these synergies. And first, I just want to reiterate that it's clear that we don't have a choice in order to reach the goals that we've set for ourselves of universal access to treatment, prevention, and care, and attaining the Millennium Development Goals. We need to be deliberate in finding and exploiting those synergies between the global health initiatives and health system strengthening. Implementers can and must scale up disease-specific initiatives in a way that achieves disease-specific results while strengthening health systems. But at the same time, I think civil society is quite concerned that the speed and the pace and the focus on results that has characterized the AIDS response is not sacrificed for an effort to leverage positive synergies. Second, I'm glad that everyone in this room agrees that we need to put an end to the toxic debate pitting AIDS funding against health systems and primary health care. I think now it's our job to go out and preach to people who aren't the choir and share this message with those stakeholders who continue to promote the idea, the incorrect idea, that AIDS investments are distorting health systems and undermining efforts to achieve universal access to comprehensive primary health care. However, we know we need to do much more. In the case of HIV, the AIDS crisis is still something that requires an extraordinary response. The investments that we've made now will have to be scaled up and sustained for decades to come with sufficient additional predictable and long-term funding. We must redouble our efforts to fill the funding gaps that were reiterated by various panels today during the conference. And likewise, I think we all recognize that our investments in advancing comprehensive primary health care in developing countries are shamefully underfunded, and that this, in turn, undermines the fight against HIV. So what about civil society? I think we have seen at the grassroots level firsthand that when planned and programmed well, disease-specific funding can strengthen health systems and delivery of health services while achieving disease-specific results. And it might be that as the rallying cry from the Durban International AIDS Conference in 2000 was to scale up access to treatment once and for all in developing countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, that the rallying cry of this AIDS conference is to scale up AIDS programs towards universal access by 2010 by using an aggressive diagonal approach built on the groundbreaking work of Dr. Frank through scaling up access to health services in Mexico. In reality, in civil society, we feel the increases in AIDS funding are like a rising tide, and we need for this rising tide to lift the struggle for comprehensive health care for all, as a rising tide can lift all boats. But in particular, we challenge donors and implementers to dramatically scale up efforts to increase the production and retention of professional health workers, as well as community health workers. These are the backbone of the AIDS response, and they're also the link toward broader investments in systems, because people are at the center of health systems. This opportunity for positive synergy between the Global Fund, PEPFAR, and other global health initiatives must be seized urgently. We've seen, for example, in the case of the Global Fund, except for a few cases, such as the case of Ethiopia and Rwanda, Malawi, and Kenya, that most countries have been surprisingly timid in their requests from GHIs, like the Global Fund, for addressing investments in scale-up of pre-service training and recurrent costs like funding salary support and increases in salaries for professional and non-professional health workers. We know that we need billions in additional funding invested in developing and implementing ambitious emergency and long-term plans to reach the clear goals that WHO has actually laid out for us, doubling the number, at least, of new health workers in Africa in order to reach the minimum target of 4.1 doctors, nurses, midwives, and community health workers per 1,000 people. WHO estimates that the cost of funding both the training and employment of those additional health workers, including the doubling of their salaries, between 2008 and 2015 would be around $75.4 billion. So we know that the need is great, and we must continue to challenge donors to pay their fair share of these investments through their investments in ODA. In addition, we recognize that there are policy barriers that have to be eliminated. Restrictions on funding by donors of recurrent costs, such as increased salaries to the public sector. It's unacceptable that nurses and other professional health workers, who are the front line of the response to the AIDS crisis, are paid a pittance when without them, our AIDS response would collapse. It's also important to recognize that we've built a system that relies on the volunteer labor of community health workers, predominantly women, including HIV-positive people. And the spirit of their commitment is inspiring and unflagging, but community health workers must be compensated a living wage for their work. And they must be given the equipment that they need in order to do their jobs well so that they can succeed and that they can maintain the credibility in their community that they deserve. Expanding the number of health workers and the level of their salaries in the public sector will also require the relaxing of existing macroeconomic and fiscal policies that are enacted by many countries with the support of the International Monetary Fund and the guidance of many ministries of finance. We must combat these artificial political barriers together. We know that there are also risks associated with the pursuit of positive synergies. Most stakeholders focused on health system strengthening are simply not accustomed to governance structures that include civil society and people living with HIV as equal partners. But innovative models of governance, for example, through the Global Fund's country coordinating mechanisms, have generated many important lessons that we hope that health system strengthening efforts will learn from. Of course, the full inclusion of marginalized groups is not something that the AIDS community has fully mastered either, neither health system strengthening efforts nor the AIDS response, which is why that we must make sure the pursuit of positive synergies between health initiatives and health system strengthening efforts do not take us a step backwards away from full community inclusion, in particular the inclusion of excluded populations such as injection drug users, men who have sex with men, and commercial sex workers. There are so many examples of cases where stigma and denial are still hindering an effective AIDS response. For example, the recent case of Uganda, where concerned people around the world are calling for that government to drop charges against HIV activists who are working to scale up access to services for sexual minorities in that country. These brave activists should be applauded, not detained and charged with crimes. Finally, we also recognize that we cannot scale up and capitalize on synergies between global health initiatives and health system strengthening without civil society integrated at all levels of decision making and implementation. These kinds of innovative models are what lead to true positive synergies. Last night, I was talking with a grassroots home-based care volunteer from Kenya from an organization called Groots. Civil society has much expertise in maximizing positive synergies because we've had to do so much with so little. And she described to me the work of thousands of women on the front lines responding to the needs of HIV-positive women, men, and their families, focusing on all of their needs, from access to free OI treatment to their needs to be empowered and know their legal rights. And these are the kinds of AIDS and health service delivery synergies that we must support and fight for. Finally, I'd like to encourage, as a step forward toward promoting positive synergies, a summary from my point of view as civil society of what we would like to see three major donors do in order to promote positive synergies. First, the Global Fund in past rounds has promoted demand creation in partnership with Stop TB and with Rollback Malaria in order to increase the size and quality of applications to the Global Fund. We need that to happen with health system strengthening, and in particular, we need it to happen with expanding the human resources for health. We need that for round 9. PEPFAR needs to expand its salary support not only in 6 focus countries, but in all 15 focus countries. And we need to see more uptake of investment in pre-service training so that that 6% figure is actually used and that 6% cap is actually broken through. Finally, we need the World Bank, who articulates that it is willing to support countries in mapping out fiscal space to scale up more comprehensive and expansionary investments to reach the MDGs and break through IMF macroeconomic and fiscal policy ceilings, we actually need to see that happen in action, because at the country level, we hear that over and over again, they're getting mixed messages that international financial institutions are tying hands when what needs to happen is the scaling up of investments along the lines that Minister Tedros illustrated to us. So I think if those kinds of reforms can be explored and taken forward with civil society at the heart of all levels of the response, well, this is the kind of synergy that we will stand for and we will fight together to implement. Thank you very much.
Well, it's always a lot of fun to follow Asia. So here we go. And Jim promised to get you into the early hours of the morning. First of all, congratulations for all of those who've stayed so long. It's really a testimony to fighting hypoglycemia. I'm going to try and be as brief as possible in the next 2 hours. Three things that I want to touch on briefly. One is the opportunity, which I think everybody here acknowledges. Three levels of research, and then the need to scale up research and learning with respect to this global health initiative and health systems interface. It's a learning opportunity, and I want to stress that because I worry that in an environment like this, there's a bit of an attitude that suggests we know what works. And I was refreshed in Asia's presentation in particular at how humble she is, and also Jim Kim, at recognizing the need to move forward, but to move forward and learn to do better. Beyond the false dichotomies, absolutely. Necessary but not sufficient conditions. We can't really talk about universal coverage for HIV only. We have to. It's necessary, but we really need to think about universal coverage for the population as a whole and for the spectrum of essential illnesses that are facing every population. Likewise, one monitoring and evaluation system for HIV, necessary but not sufficient. We need one monitoring and evaluation system for the health system as a whole. So, how can we learn to strengthen performance of the health sector? This has an issue of speed. We want to do it faster, and there's an issue we need to learn if we're going to do it faster. And how can we attain that range of health sector goals, fairness and financing, equity and responsiveness? Those are non-trivial challenges, and no one knows how to do it automatically. How can we learn to do better? But let me finish by saying we can't afford to miss this learning opportunity, not only because we want to show evidence of good returns on investment, but also because we want to avoid this. And this is the situation of TB. And here, as written by TB authors themselves, TB experts, it was poor TB services that were deemed to be the underlying reason for the emergence of XDR-TB. And if you look at the list of things that they identify, these are all dimensions of health systems that are weak. No vehicles, no TB satellite centers, inadequate supervision of patients, et cetera, et cetera. Will we be in a situation with respect to HIV because of the same situation? And I think if we're going to learn from history, as Peter Piot was compelling us to, then we need to act now so that 5 years from now, we're not looking at a similar situation with respect to HIV. So, three levels approach to research. First is to learn at the grassroots, community, clinical, the coal face, the delivery models that Jim was talking about. The second is to look at system supports. Those are the pillars, the foundations, the building blocks, the functions. And the third is to take a big picture view and ask some really fundamental questions, whether what we think is an input and having an outcome is actually, in fact, the case. So the coalface. We have evidences of synergies, and Rifat's presentation suggested that the evidence really is insufficient to draw any strong conclusions. But when you listen to people on the ground, and I stress that because they know best, patients, providers, information systems, supplies, infrastructure, financing, you can see and hear and visit and witness evidences of improvement. But our systems for capturing those improvements are not good. How do we improve those systems for capturing those things? Systems, synergies leading to systems transformation. This community health worker is holding a PDA. And here I think there's a wonderful opportunity looking how information and communication technologies could really assist in delivery models. Electronic medical records, we know, are already making a big difference in places that people didn't think they were possible to implement. So there's a really interesting technological opportunity in understanding how delivery systems might function more effectively. But also perhaps some unlikely bed partners. And Mark Dybul mentioned chronic diseases. Okay? If you look at NCD strategies and compare them to HIV strategies, from national plans through to continuing care, there's very little difference. Why aren't we working with the NCD strategies much more effectively? There's no reason for separation between NCD strategies and HIV strategies. Thirdly, how can we learn from those who wouldn't find themselves in the healthcare sector formally? Muhammad Yunus, Fazl Abed, they started with poor women and integrated them, provided them an opportunity through microcredit, and have innovated scaling up oral rehydration therapy in Bangladesh, for example, in a very, very short period of time. Essential system supports. This gets to the building blocks, the functions that people have been talking about, the linkages in terms of service delivery, the stewardship issues, the financing, workforce, infrastructure. But here we need to think about this when we're coming from the Global Health Initiative's perspective, because some of these things require focus in and of themselves. The macro shortages that were identified across 57 countries in the World Health Report of 2006, 4.3 million workers, is not going to be solved by increasing the size of a class by 10%. You need to think fundamentally about how this system, subsystem of a health system, needs to change in order to perform much more effectively. And in that regard, global health initiatives need to think about how they can synergize themselves with those systems prescriptions. The crisis in education here, institutional insufficiencies, accreditation absent, faculty fleeing, precarious pedagogic models, students starving, and investment inefficiency, huge investment inefficiency. Hotel training is rampant. Evidence suggests that it is highly inefficient. But more worrying is the substitution effect in terms of the way overseas development assistance is being used for technical assistance. And it's a growth industry. There's an increasing share of technical assistance that is being used in terms of total ODA over time. What that represents is it represents a substitution of investment in terms of direct investment in building that capacity in countries. So we need to think about that moving forward. Finally, comprehensive assessment. This is me sitting at WHO on holiday, as Stuart suggested. And when you look at the big picture, this is what happens at WHO. Sorry. Those books on the shelf come tumbling down. But we need to think about the big picture. The International Health Partnership has put that big picture together in terms of a monitoring and evaluation framework, which looks at the inputs, processes, outputs, outcomes, and impacts, and along the way looks at the sentinel indicators that will give us an indication as to whether those things are having the intended impact all along the way. A lot of development is needed. But it also begs the question of whether or not we have the right tools to understand whether health systems are performing as they should. And in clinical medicine, we rely very heavily on the gold standard RCT. But as Rifat Atun's presentation suggested, when you look at the articles and boil them down according to clinical medicine criteria of gold standards, we get down to 12 articles and only two from developing countries. What have we lost in understanding? And what perhaps do we need to rethink about what constitutes gold standard evidence? So, retrospectively, case studies, which Jim is pursuing at Harvard, prospectively, four-cell design, real-time experiments and implementation that took place here in Mexico under Julio's leadership, or innovative randomization, which some researchers are approaching at the moment, or new approaches to research which draw on complex adaptive systems and complex sciences. Scaling up research and learning. It's an emerging field of research. It needs to go beyond the RCT. We need science to illuminate the black box of delivery, comparative analyses of high and low performers. And I would argue the move towards savvy versus serendipity in striking systems synergies. In order to do that, we have to build essential research capacities. And that means building the information and evidentiary systems in countries, investing in the research workforce, and also in the institutions in which those researchers find themselves. Finally, look at this rapid growth area. Somebody already mentioned the Doris Duke Foundation's Africa Health Initiative. PEPFAR is promoting public health evaluation. Gates is developing a delivery initiative. The IHP has the Common Monitoring and Evaluation Framework. Gavi and the Fund have these health system strengthening windows. Can we work together and bring this constituency together in such a way that we can learn, such that we accelerate performance in the near term? The Director General hosted a meeting in early June. We've set up a task force called Scaling Up Research and Learning for Better Health. We see this event very much as part of that, and we hope to bring these recommendations to the Honorable Minister of Mali in Bamako in November, when he will be hosting a ministerial forum on research for health. Thank you very much.
Thank you to all the speakers. Team delighted us with a collection of alliterations. And before we have listeners leaving, I would like to, I think it's fair for those who have held their questions. It's obvious that we're past the time, but I know that there was a colleague from the audience, and we are going to have to do what every health system does, which is to ration. And so we're going to ration the participation. I apologize for that, but please, if you could make your questions brief.
Oui, bonsoir. Mais ce n'est pas une question, c'est plutôt des préoccupations. Moi, je trouve extrêmement intéressant cette nouvelle initiative de synergie positive. Moi, j'ai de grandes préoccupations, surtout par rapport justement à différentes crises qu'on va pouvoir faire face dans le processus justement d'avancement avec cette synergie-là. Il y a la crise de connaissances avec toujours des grandes universités qui continuent justement à produire des chercheurs en santé publique avec une vision très conventionnelle. Il y a aussi la crise économique qui se manifeste par aujourd'hui ce qu'on appelle la crise alimentaire mondiale. Il y a aussi les crises politiques. Face à ces crises-là, je pense, si on veut avancer avec cette synergie positive, qu'est-ce que vous allez faire? Qu'est-ce que vous allez élaborer en termes de stratégie, justement, pour contaminer ces universités qui continuent à produire, justement, des chercheurs très résistants face à cette nouvelle situation? Qu'est-ce que vous comptez faire aussi face au néolibéralisme qui continue justement à mettre des freins face justement à cette nouvelle initiative? Moi, je pense qu'il ne faut pas dire, bon, écoutez, il y a de très belles initiatives, on continue à foncer, et puis le système, le statu quo reste le même. Et on a toujours des universités qui continuent justement à produire des résistants à ce que vous faites là. Vraiment des gens très, très résistants. Parce que l'épidémiologie conventionnelle, la santé publique avec une vision très coincée, ne va pas pouvoir suivre cette route-là. Comment vous allez pouvoir contaminer ces gens-là pour qu'ils arrivent à s'embarquer dans le processus? Ça, c'est très, très, très important. Parce que sinon, il va y avoir justement toute une cacophonie dans les interventions, comme cela se passe en Haïti. En Haïti, nous avons justement une intervention holistique de Partners in Health et nous avons justement des interventions éclatées de justement l'épidémiologie conventionnelle, de santé publique conventionnelle. Alors, comment justement arriver à résoudre ce problème pour freiner le processus et de cette vision et d'épidémiologie conventionnelle?
Merci beaucoup. On va écouter les autres interventions. Please.
Yes, thank you. As Peter Piot said, the needs of health systems were in many countries ignored throughout the 90s. They were ignored a great deal longer. This was a tragedy. Throughout the 1980s and 90s, the voice of trade unions representing health workers was largely ignored when financial restrictions imposed on public services were strangling health systems. Wages were frozen and working conditions were adversely affected. In addition, trade union rights of health workers have been severely restricted in many countries. As we've heard from many speakers, some improvements are being made, but starting from such a low base, the changes are marginal. Wages are still below the poverty level. Why is the voice of these workers still not properly represented in the deliberations about what is good for them? They are patronized in this process. Meetings are taking place about health workers without those workers being present or their elected representatives. Until their voice is included, the proposals for change will not be trusted by those workers and they will not be sustainable. They have a right to be heard directly and not through those who claim to speak on their behalf. They have real experience and the knowledge and reality of the healthcare systems, and they need to have a voice in this process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that's a very profound statement. Please.
Good evening. I'm Anne Starrs. I work with Family Care International. And I have to confess that I'm not a member of the choir, although I would be happy to sing along if the songbook could be changed slightly. In the discussion we've had this evening, I think one of the issues that hasn't really been fully addressed or discussed is this question of what are the health outcomes or the health indicators that we're looking at when we're assessing the impact of health system strengthening, and in particular the issue of vertical funding or global health initiatives and their relationship to health system strengthening. As the head of an organization that focuses on maternal and reproductive health, I can testify to the fact that maternal mortality has indicated for many, many years, certainly more than 20 years, that health systems are not functioning. The adoption of maternal mortality, of the ability of children to survive diseases like pneumonia, are key indicators that need to be incorporated into the process, the framework for assessing the impact of health system strengthening. I would have liked to ask Mark Deibel, but I think he left us quite a while ago, whether these issues, these indicators of maternal health, of child health — he looked at infant mortality, but he didn't look at any of the maternal health indicators — are being used and to assess the impact of PEPFAR in particular and some of the other global health initiatives.
Thank you for your comment. Please.
Thank you. My name is Nkandluo. I come from Zambia. First of all, I want to congratulate those of you who have started thinking about the importance of health systems strengthening. And I want to say that Africa is in a crisis right now. Our health services or health systems really, to say the least, are non-existent. And we can design, we can talk about research. I do not see how we're going to achieve that if we do not really look at the issue of human resource. It's a crisis. We do not have the numbers that are required to do certain things. I looked at all those beautiful presentations of what needs to be done, but it requires human beings. And as we look at human resource, I've met a number of people in my country who come to assess human resource. They're looking at how many nurses do we have, why are they leaving the country and working abroad. But they are not looking at the human resource that is in country. Everywhere else in the world except Africa, when people leave universities or colleges, they are employed on contract. What that does, it makes them work very hard because they want their contract renewed. When they have a lot of experience, they are employed permanently. In Africa, go into the villages, you find nurses, radiographers, doctors tilling the land and begging. So I would like to see a very different approach taken on looking at the human resource. And I'm glad Dr. Kim talks about the fact that we do not understand or we don't have evidence for and against integration. But these are the things that have been promoted that we need to integrate. And one time I asked a question that we need to integrate AIDS, TB, malaria, STIs. And I said, how do you integrate a failing program in another failing program? So I'm glad that these things are coming in our discussion. And we don't have a lot of time to talk because so many other people want to speak. But I just want to encourage those of you who are sitting at the helm of discussing these issues not to do business as usual, but to think outside the box. And let us have a new approach to this systems thinking. That's what we need. And it must happen.
Thank you very much. That's a great contribution. Thank you for making it. Please.
Amalia del Riego, I'm from the Pan American Health Organization, World Health Organization, and I applaud the panel for the good delivery and rich discussions, and I feel very happy to see that we have consensus that the discussion is not anymore whether we need to go for vertical or integrated approaches. I would like to, and that definitely we do need evidence because unfortunately, the situations are not black and white. We have developed and we have a recent experience in the Dominican Republic with a comprehensive evaluation of the health system's response to HIV. And I would like to share with you three or four key findings. One, in a country with 99% of institutional deliveries and more than 80% of antenatal care coverage, with Global Fund, World Bank, and other significant resources for HIV, PMTCT effective coverage at the time of the evaluation was around 9% after 5 years of investment. A parallel supply and management system established would ensure that there is no stock out for ARVs in the country. However, due to being totally parallel to the national system, it resulted in high prices of ARVs, which in a country that actually was obtaining purchasing prices the lowest in the region, one of the lowest in the region. An establishment of around more than 50 standalone HIV clinics that run totally parallel to the existing systems and services that actually are in the same hospitals and health centers of the public setting, but are managed, run, staff, and have supportive services outside of the facility. To put it simple, with very good patient information system for the outpatient in that clinic, with no idea of what is happening with hospital discharges for HIV-related illnesses in the same health center. of hospital. And with human resources employed with project funds that gain 3 or 4 times the salary of the public sector, and of course, we may not be able to say that that is a distortion, but definitely it's going to be a challenge for the health system to retain these people when project or loan funds are finished. And to mention a few, an approach in terms of organization of healthcare delivery in the HIV services that is in total contradiction with the current health sector reform that is implemented in the country. Perhaps in the health sector reform, the HIV ARV treatment was left out of the family basic scheme for insurance. I would like to again congratulate the panel. I would like to invite the panel and the rest to pass by the WHO booth. We have a publication of the report available for everyone, and we would like to definitely encourage the need for more evidence and share and take advantage of also all of what has been shared today with the group. Thank you.
Muchas gracias. Thank you.
I'm Sania Nishtar from Pakistan, and I'd like to join the other commenters in commending this excellent panel. I have a very down-to-earth operational question for the World Health Organization. Because throughout this panel, while we've been talking about health systems within the context of global health initiatives, but global health initiatives constitute just one component of official development assistance. And the other sources, as you know better than myself, are the various bilateral and multilateral agencies, and in recent years, increasingly, the private foundations. Now, by and large, all of these other channels of official development assistance also follow the vertical disease stream patterns of priorities for allocating resources within countries. And it is plausible to assume that the potential weaknesses or the possible synergies wherever they exist would be generic to all of them. So my question to WHO is, would all these channels of official development assistance fall within the remit of your initiative, of your positive synergies initiative? And if they will, how will you manage the political sensitivities of certain large bilateral donors? If you allow, Mr. Chairman, just a quick comment as a follow-up. We see that there is now a burgeoning of interest in health systems. Your comments throughout the table have reiterated that. But we see that the interest in health systems is sparked by new initiatives. I'm reminded, Tim, in particular, our last conference call, where there was an increased attention to normative guidance on health reform and on reforming health systems. And I'm just commenting and reiterating the importance of that as a backdrop to all that is being discussed and to everything that around which there will be an accelerated momentum, hopefully in the years to come. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comment and your thoughtful question. We'll listen to the last participant from the audience, please.
Hi, I'm Bernard Rivers. I run AIDSPAN, which is a watchdog of the Global Fund, and I edit AIDSPAN's newsletter, Global Fund Observer. The question tonight is, does investing in global health initiatives, by which we mean most obviously the Global Fund and PEPFAR, help or harm health systems? The panel has strongly said yes. It's been an incredible panel. My head is spinning. I just want you to know that. 2 hours of nonstop fascinating stuff. I want a transcript. I want all the slides. It's really an incredibly useful session. But I just wanted to add one observation. One thing that has not been said is that, in effect, governments and politicians and members of the public in Western countries which are funding these major initiatives are agreeing to give money to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And we're saying, and we know, and I think it's terrific, that the money which is being given for these initiatives, these vertical initiatives, not only necessarily strengthen health systems in order to be able to fight these three diseases, but have the the consequential effect that those health systems are stronger as a result of this work, and therefore those health systems can be used for other things, other initiatives, you know, dealing with completely other problems, health problems. And that's great. But do we have to only do it this way? Is this the only way that money can be raised from Western countries to support health systems? Are there other ways that money can be raised, additional ways, not alternative, but additional ways to strengthen health systems where we can be a little more open with the sources of the funding and with the politicians and the public who support this? What could be done to do things in a more open way in addition? And I just want to raise one idea. I don't know if I think it's a good idea. This is a genuine question. Would it be an appropriate idea over the next few years for the Global Fund to morph from being the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria into being the Global Health Fund? Thank you.
Thank you very much. A very interesting idea that I'm sure has crossed many minds and is bound to generate a lot of discussion. And you do touch a very key issue, which is the political dimension of particularly in donor countries, of specifying specific deliveries as a way of making a lot of bilateral and multilateral aid acceptable to taxpayers in those countries. I think this has been an extraordinary session. I want to, first of all, thank all the panelists. I think we have heard a wealth of extraordinary presentations. I realize it was a very packed program, and it was a challenge to end on time. I was asked to make a summation, but I'm not even going to attempt to do anything like that, as I believe we have already heard extraordinarily insightful presentations, and also the comments from the members of the audience have been, I think, very, very interesting. I just want to reiterate that this is an extraordinary moment, and as I think has been the repeated message, we just can't miss the opportunity to take this convergence of new sources of funding, new interests around specific deliverables, and new interest in the development of better health systems to really move that agenda forward. I think this the fact that even at this late hour, we have still a substantial number of you here who speaks to the energy that characterizes this community, and I hope that energy will be translated into much better health systems in our world. Let me turn over to Dr. Carissa Tian, our host for today, for some final comments.
Thank you. I just want to be brief, and I want to thank you who have remained so long, and certainly those who were here for attending this session. We are utilizing and ensuring that one of the key roles of WHO, which is the convening role, and this is where we see that we can bring great benefit to this work. We are working with all of our partners, and we will work with all of you, and certainly to advance what is the knowledge that already exists, what is the knowledge gap, how can we fill this knowledge gap, but very importantly, how we can translate this evidence into policy and from policy into action. For me, it means nothing until we have affected the lives of those who continue to suffer. And so I think we are in this work together, and I want us really to work at it together, and I will ensure that that happens in my capacity. The Minister of Mali is here, and he really was our co-chair. He hasn't had an opportunity. I probably want to invite him to Monsieur Ministre, si vous voulez. Domo?
Ah, d'accord. Merci beaucoup. Je m'excuse de prendre la parole tard parce que, vous savez, les gens sont un peu fatigués. Et Bien sûr, tout ce qui a été développé ici a été bien développé de façon pertinente. C'est pour cela que je me dois de remercier et de féliciter tous les panélistes qui se sont succédés à cette tribune pour leur brillante et pertinente présentation. Mais ce que je retiens de façon générale, tout le monde s'accorde sur un aspect extrêmement important. Il s'agit du renforcement du système de santé. Il s'agit également pour nous aujourd'hui de nous concentrer sur les stratégies communes. Et il s'agit également, comme certains l'ont développé ici, d'aller de l'avant, mais surtout de développer les synergies positives tout en tenant compte de la complémentarité des différentes initiatives. Je crois que c'est ce qui a été développé et tout le monde est d'accord qu'il faut passer par le développement de tout ceci pour lutter contre la maladie, pour prévenir la maladie et particulièrement lutter contre le sida qui nous réunit aujourd'hui ici. Donc c'est en passant également par cela que nous pouvons atteindre les résultats attendus de nos différents programmes. Aujourd'hui également, tout le monde est d'accord qu'il y a une urgence et cette urgence-là nous amène à aller très vite et c'est pour cela que certains l'ont dit ici, nous devons agir ensemble ici et maintenant. Donc cela dit, mesdames, messieurs, si j'ai été invité ici également, c'est parce que mon pays développe une expérience dans le domaine des synergies. Et je me dois aujourd'hui de profiter de cette tribune-là, certainement pour vous parler de cela. Donc, je vous remercie sincèrement pour avoir invité mon pays à cette importante rencontre. Et je dois également féliciter l'équipe de l'OMS pour les efforts constants et son engagement à accompagner les pays afin de concrétiser l'approche des synergies positives qui certainement va contribuer à maximiser les résultats attendus de nos différents programmes, je le disais tantôt. Et au regard du niveau des indicateurs retenus et des délais impartis pour l'atteinte des OMD, les stratégies visant à accélérer l'atteinte des résultats escomptés des programmes prioritaires s'avèrent indispensables. À ce titre, les approches innovantes fondées sur les bases factuelles devraient être mises à échelle. Ceci va nécessiter un renforcement du partenariat fortement coordonné pour des actions harmonieuses sous le leadership des pays. Cela permettra certainement une meilleure utilisation des ressources disponibles, l'identification et la mobilisation des ressources additionnelles pour la mise en œuvre des actions. L'intérêt porté sur certaines maladies a conduit au développement d'initiatives mondiales en leur faveur. Je vais parler du cas de Gavi Alliance, je vais parler également du cas du Fonds mondial, donc des expériences qui ont été développées ici. Cependant, quel que soit l'emphase mise sur ces maladies, la pérennité des résultats reste tributaire d'un renforcement conséquent des systèmes de santé qui restent le socle. Le renforcement des soins de santé primaires, dans son application optimale, aura un effet catalytique sur le système de santé avec un impact considérable sur la lutte contre les maladies faisant l'objet du programme spécifique. Ainsi, une approche efficiente de la gestion des programmes nécessite que l'attention soit portée sur les synergies positives à développer avec ces initiatives. Le Mali, mon pays, qui s'est déjà engagé dans cette démarche, va saisir l'opportunité des initiatives pour renforcer davantage son système de santé. Il est important aujourd'hui, compte tenu de tout ce que nous avons entendu, que l'OMS continue à appuyer les pays pour mieux asseoir ses stratégies à travers le développement d'expertise et de directives pouvant guider les pays dans ce sens. Tout en saluant les efforts déployés dans le domaine du partenariat, la délégation du Mali, que j'ai l'honneur de conduire ici, intervient également pour soutenir cette initiative sur les synergies positives. Je le disais, mon pays a déjà développé un certain nombre de choses à ce niveau-là. Et depuis plusieurs années, nous avons un programme national de santé qui est le cadre unique de référence pour tous les acteurs intervenant dans le secteur sous le leadership du ministère de la Santé. La mise en œuvre de ce programme se fait à travers un programme décennal. Ainsi, dans la perspective de renforcer cet appui, le Mali a signé tout récemment également l'IHP, le Partenariat international pour la santé. Actuellement, le ministère de la Santé travaille à l'élaboration d'un compact qui sera finalisé à la fin de l'année 2008 avec la participation des différents acteurs. Ceci permettra de renforcer le leadership déjà affirmé du ministère de la Santé, mais également, à travers ce processus, les différentes initiatives mondiales sont inscrites de manière complémentaire. Donc, il n'y a pas de contradiction, afin de disposer d'une synergie d'action harmonieuse, cohérente, dans un cadre commun de mise en œuvre et de suivi-évaluation. Mesdames, Messieurs, en tant que ministre de la Santé, je fais aujourd'hui face à de nombreuses initiatives qui permettent de mobiliser des ressources importantes pour la prévention et la lutte contre la maladie. Dans le contexte actuel, où les indicateurs sont alarmants dans beaucoup de pays, il n'est pas opportun de s'installer dans la démarche qui se focalise sur la dichotomie entre système de santé et initiative mondiale, mais plutôt dans celle qui se préoccupe des liens positifs à établir entre les deux. Et c'est pour cela que j'avais parlé de complémentarité. Il importe de développer ces liens afin que ces initiatives soient des opportunités pour renforcer le système afin d'accélérer la prévention et la lutte contre la maladie. Dans cette perspective, le Mali a développé une expérience positive qui a permis d'inscrire son partenariat avec Gavi pour le renforcement du système de santé dans la complémentarité avec les interventions des autres partenaires. Actuellement, notre pays, le Mali, a engagé une collaboration technique avec l'équipe de Gavi, celle de Global Fund et celle en charge de l'ILM, l'initiative pour le leadership ministériel, dans ce sens. Donc, une rencontre est prévue avant la signature de compact avec ses partenaires dans le cadre du comité de suivi et de coordination du programme national afin de renforcer leur intégration, leur complémentarité dans un cadre global commun de gestion. Mesdames, Messieurs, la nécessité de développer les synergies positives entre les systèmes et les initiatives mondiales est devenue très pertinente. C'est pourquoi il est urgent de développer la recherche dans le domaine. Ce domaine de recherche qui se basera fortement sur les expériences en cours dans de nombreux pays devra être inscrite dans les priorités de recherche. Ceci contribuera au développement des bases factuelles sur les approches y afférentes afin de les reproduire à échelle de manière adaptée au contexte des différents pays. Il est important, je saisis l'occasion, de rappeler que le Mali abritera en novembre 2008, comme cela a été indiqué par Tim, que le Mali abritera en novembre 2008, donc dans moins de 4 mois, le Forum mondial sur la recherche pour la santé. À cet égard, je voudrais, au nom du gouvernement du Mali, lancer un appel à tous les invités et les participants inscrits au Forum ministériel sur la recherche pour la santé pour assurer leur présence effective et leur contribution aux travaux. Ceci nous offre une occasion d'élargir la portée du sommet ministériel sur la recherche pour la santé, tenu ici même à Mexico en 2004, pour couvrir le renforcement de la recherche pour la santé, le développement et l'équité. Un accent particulier devra être mis également sur les approches pouvant produire les bases factuelles nécessaires à l'éclairage des décideurs politiques et à l'élaboration des programmes. Ainsi, des solutions appropriées permettront d'améliorer l'état de santé des populations dans les pays en voie de développement, particulièrement dans la région africaine, où les indicateurs de santé, malgré les progrès accomplis, demeurent encore préoccupants. Mesdames, Messieurs, pour terminer, cette rencontre sera une opportunité pour davantage orienter la recherche sur les besoins prioritaires des pays afin de les doter d'outils qui contribueront significativement aux résultats attendus pour un mieux-être des populations concernées. Avant de terminer, je voudrais vous assurer du soutien et de l'engagement de mon pays à renforcer la collaboration avec l'OMS et tous les partenaires ainsi que les différents pays impliqués dans ce processus. Je vous remercie. Excusez-moi d'avoir été long. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. Thank you to all panelists, and thank you for being such a wonderful audience, and have a good night, everyone. Thank you.